The backwoods of Louisiana is now home to a new breed of millionaire, my family. Pretty scary, huh?
My idea of happiness is killing things.
40 years ago, my father, Phil Robertson, invented a revolutionary kind of duck call that changed the duck hunting industry and our way of life forever.
Looky here, looky here. Good times have come our way.
As CEO, I've turned my dad's one-man operation into a booming family enterprise.
Willie, he took the whole thing way further than I ever would. Send me a check every month.
Okay. My brother Jace designs the duck calls.
Come on! Go, go!
And manages the assembly team.
Somebody's gonna get killed fooling around on this mess.
Uncle Si heads up operations.
Come and get it.
And my mom, Miss Kay,
that old school brain,
is always cooking up new ways to expand the brand.
Welcome, student.
I gotta say, though, money didn't change some things.
I don't like meat from the grocery store. It makes me nervous.
Happy, happy, happy. We still managed to stay true to ourselves.
Amen.
I am not ashamed of the gospel.
Because it is the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes. First for the Jew,
then to the Gentile. For in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed.
A righteousness that is by faith, from first to last, just as it is written, the righteous will live by faith.
I am not ashamed.
I am not ashamed.
I am unashamed. What about you?
All right, that's the trailer for what is called the Unashamed podcast of the Robertson clan. And by the way, Phil Robertson, its patriarch, is with us now, along with his sons, Alan and Jace of Duck Dynasty fame. He has a brand new book out, The Theft of America's Soul. It is a fascinating read, and it's on Amazon.com, Hannity.com, bookstores everywhere. And we're actually doing something very brave and courageous. We're allowing all these three guys to interview me, kind of, sort of, for their podcast. Guys, welcome to the studio. So what are you guys here for today?
Our brand new podcast is called Unashamed with Phil Robertson. It's Jace, it's me, it's Dad, it's...
Where's Willie? How did Willie get out of coming to New York?
We don't let Willie get anywhere near serious discussions. You know, man. You've been around him before, right?
Oh, yeah. No, I've been around him before. He thinks he's the boss. And yeah. You know, it's the great patriarch,
that's right,
Phil, of the family that did it all.
What Willie does is he waits and he sees if it's successful. And then if it is, he comes in and takes credit for it.
Is that what happened with the whole Duck Dynasty?
Well, yeah. Commander. Dad started the business and Willie took over and now it's such a big deal, right?
Follow the money, Sean. Okay. Follow the money.
Right. It's Uncle Si. Why isn't he up in New York? You couldn't handle
Si's
it?
Si's famous line is, he said, boys, let me just explain this. He said, I've acted like an idiot my entire life. He said, but I never thought I'd find a bunch of fools like A&E to pay me to do it.
That's true. But he's got a great sense of humor.
He does.
I had the pleasure of interviewing you guys. So you guys control this interview, because otherwise I'm going to just take over.
Look, I know that's what you do. So the first thing I thought of is, we call this Unashamed because it's been obvious from the family's sake that we stand up for what we believe in no matter what. I mean, obviously we had a huge dust up with A&E over it and other things that have happened. And by the way, Sean, you were one of the first guys that called us to check on us and to help us. And we appreciate that, because there were others. I mean, but not many, but people that said, I know what you guys are about to go through, you know?
Well, the one thing, everybody selectively hears what they want to hear. And I was raised a Catholic, but I did go to 12 years of Catholic school. In high school, it was a seminary. I had to study. We went to Mass every day. We studied Latin. You know, this was serious. You had to say you would consider the calling in the church except 3 weeks in, they said everybody but Hannity because we don't want you. And by the way, and that is a true story. No lie behind that. I was pretty incorrigible. I was 17, 18 years old, tending bar till 4:30 in the morning.
Right.
You know, when I was 17. And it was just a different life that I had. But I do have a conscience. I believe that's a living God within all of us that I know pretty darn well when I'm doing wrong and when I'm doing right.
Right.
And my conscience convicts me, tells me to knock it off. I mean.
By the way.
Yeah, you're telling me to knock it off. Go ahead.
No, the people you are sparring with.
Yeah.
Every day, you just said the magic word. Their conscience has been seared over as with a hot iron. You see what I'm saying? Because when the lies come out and you say, wait a minute, how could you lie like the conscience? It's just seared over. You see what I'm saying? Plenty of texts say that.
Many, you know, there's a reason why one of the big 10 in the Bible, if we're going to go there, is thou shalt not bear false witness.
That's right.
Because it's so damaging.
That's right. Satan, Jesus said, is the father of lies.
Deceit.
And the father of murder. And I'm looking at both of them. The ones you're dealing with are champions of both. And it's a tough battle you're in. That's why we talk to you about spiritual matters, because we want to make sure that God has given you his spirit. Born of water, and you must be born again of water and the Spirit. So when you look at that, you say, we're trying to make sure you've got the power to withstand the onslaught you are currently participating in.
But you see what I'm saying, Sean? Interesting point about this line. Look, you can deal with anything, you can work out anything, but when you have lies, you can't work that out. That's the only thing I punish my kids for. I'm like, I don't care what you did. Let's hear
it.
You know, I have my daughter's phone. I picked it up. I was like, is there anything in this phone before I check it? I check my kids' phones. And I'm like, is there anything in here? She's like, nope. I got in there. She's thinking all this stuff has been deleted because it's, you know. There's I found it. And I'm like, what happened to this? I'm not going to find anything here. And that's what I was trying to explain to her. No matter what you do, we can work through it. When you lie, when we can't discover the truth, any progress ends right there.
That's where you are with what the current struggle you're in. Spiritual warfare. The evil one works in those. He works in them. So we're warriors. You say, how come they are in lockstep and their mind is just straight and nothing seems? How many of them have you seen that you changed their mind?
You're none. Like,
that's what I'm saying.
99% that went down a 2+ year narrative full of lying, full of abuse of power, corruption, and they did it willingly. Listen, I've always thought for myself, I tell a story that I was a local radio host in Atlanta when the Richard Jewell thing happened and the Olympic bombing, and I was on the air at the time when the Atlanta Journal-Constitution came out with the headline that he fits the profile of the lone bomber because he lives with his mother. And I'm on the air.
I remember it.
That was the dumbest thing I've ever heard. I'm on the air. Dumbest thing I've ever heard. That doesn't mean it fits. Yeah. He lives with his mother probably because he doesn't make enough money.
That's right.
So I didn't know it at the time. Richard Jewell was listening to my radio show. And I was the only one in the media that said, I'm not rushing to a conclusion here. And it's not guilt by accusation in America. And it ended up, he gave me one of his first interviews when it was all said and done. He died 44. I'm sure the press killed him, and he did not like it. But then, you know, the media has been wrong on George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin. I was right. I actually took time to go down there and talk to the people. When the Duke lacrosse case came up, I went out to Long Island and Garden City, and I met with the parents and kids. I did my own research.
Right.
UVA or Baltimore, Maryland, or Ferguson, Missouri, or the Cambridge police, or believing that Donald Trump absolutely could win this election,
right,
or going back. I think I was the only voice vetting Obama and, you know, Frank Marshall Davis and Alinsky and Black Liberation Theology and ACORN and community organizing. And he sat in the pews of the Church of GD America for 20 plus years, and he started his political career in the home of two unrepentant domestic terrorists that bombed the Pentagon, the Capitol, and New York City police headquarters, and 9/11 2001 quoted in the New York Times as saying, we wish we did more. That's where he started. So, you know, the answer to your question is, I don't think about what I do.
Yeah.
I just do it.
Yeah.
You know, have people said, Hannity, you're probably going to have a pre-dawn raid coming pretty soon. You know, when I'm taking on, you know, pretty powerful people. And the intelligence community, only a few. The 99% are good, honorable Americans right. that protect us. Same with the FBI, just a few. The 99% do their job and obey the laws and would never abuse power. But for me, it's not like I have a choice. It just is, you know, I do what I do. You do what you do. And I know it's the right thing because I'm driven to do it. Whether I want to or not, I'm stuck doing it.
Listen how serious this is. This is how you can recognize the Spirit of God. Every spirit that acknowledges that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is from God. But every spirit who does not acknowledge Jesus is not from God. He's the spirit of the Antichrist, which you've heard is coming. Now watch this. You, dear children, are from God and have overcome them. Because the one who is in you, God's Spirit, is greater than the one who is in the world. They're from the world and therefore speak from the viewpoint of the world, and the world listens to them. We are from God, and whoever knows God listens to us. But whoever is not from God, listen to this, does not listen to us. That explains why you say, it's just like they're in lockstep, coordinated evil from the evil one himself. And you say, what we're telling you is, we say, Sean, make sure you got the power within you to withstand it. We're just saying, do this. It will help greatly. The one in you is stronger than the one in them.
You all watch The Passion of the Christ.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I cannot watch that movie.
It's tough.
And it not take me down.
Yeah. That's right.
That movie touches me deeply. I believe all, Phil, I know you wanted to dunk me in the back of in the swamp with the alligators, and I said, I'll do it, but I'm not doing it there.
Trust me when I tell you, we want to dunk you anywhere.
Okay, get a bucket. Now you can dunk me right here. I don't care. Here's some water flying all over my head.
Well, Sean, you're a good American.
You really are.
The reason we connected with you immediately.
I want to tell you one thing.
Sure.
You know how you know there's a God? Okay, I argue with atheists on this radio program. And I say, so you don't believe in God, okay? You believe in the Big Bang Theory. I said, well, what you believe then is that all of this energy existed. You're not giving me a source of the energy, just existed. And then it collides together and creates perfection. Yeah. You know,
details.
The moon, the sun, the stars, the planet, gravity, all
we're
humankind.
We're traveling at 66,700 miles an hour as I speak. The planet.
Right.
And it's doing like this, turning like this at 1,000 miles an hour.
Universes within universes within universes. That
and
just happened?
And it's
no way.
No way. And it's going around, 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 right? You say, you talk about precise. We're just the right distance from the sun. Mercury's too close. Venus is too close. We're just right. Mars is too
perfect.
Far. Perfect.
The only ones that's not perfect is us.
That did.
But by the way, you know.
But you can be considered, viewed as 100% flawlessly perfect once you believe Jesus died, was buried, and raised from the dead. And look.
I already believe it.
I know it. Now you've got to enact that. You've got to die to sin. You, the old you.
Well, you.
Bury
it's
it.
Kind of, it's kind
you
of
talked
victory.
About your old life. You are just as bad as me, just to be very
worse.
Blunt.
Maybe worse.
I'm admitting my incorrigibility.
Your woman was right when she told you. When you said, look, them old graybeards said, I need to be baptized. But, honey, what do you think? You're in divinity school. She said, Sean, because Al told me this, that you told. Said, Sean, technically they're right. I said, well, technically, if we're right. His woman and all three of the people that love him, the Robinson clan, if we're all technically right, move.
All right. Well, look, we need to
all
go.
Right,
Sean, you're a busy man. Thank you so much for
good
being a part of
all.
Our podcast.
Don't get kicked out of hotels, Jason, next time.
I'll try.
You know, you're up in New York City.
And well, facial profiling.
We'll have more on this podcast about our friend Sean Hannity. Thanks,
oh, boy,
Sean.
That's dangerous.
It.
Thank you all for having me.
All I'm saying to you,
It ought to be a woman's choice. I'm not about to be as a male tell a woman what to do with her body. She has the right to make that decision herself, to rape her instead. Some kids are unwanted, so you kill them now, kill them later. You bring them in the world unwanted, unloved, then you send them to the electric chair. So you kill them now, kill them later.
The economy added more than 250,000 jobs, better than economists expected. Unemployment is at its lowest level in almost 50 years. Wages grew faster than prices did. Do you give President Trump the credit?
I give our workers and our businesses the credit, Jake. When you're out there across the country, you see people working harder and harder every day. And this has meant that our businesses are strong and we're selling American goods. That being said, a lot of people aren't sharing in this prosperity because of the cost of college, the cost of health care, the fact that the president had promised that he would bring down the prices of their prescription drugs, and that just hasn't happened.
Unemployment is the lowest it's been since I was 9 months old. You're really not going to give President Trump any credit for that in terms of his tax cuts or deregulation or anything he's done?
You know what I'm thinking about? I'm thinking about when we were in that downturn and President Obama came into office and he had to deal with that with the Congress to try to, one, right the financial industry, and then, two, get us on the road to recovery. And I remember that the Republicans were giving him grief when he took any credit for that. So I think that we have had policies in place, starting with President Obama, that have aided that recovery.
Are you concerned that impeachment talk may actually help the president's reelection?
I'm concerned that if we don't impeach this president, he will get reelected. If we don't impeach him, he will say he has been vindicated.
You have said that you think that the House Judiciary Committee should open impeachment proceedings.
I think they should begin the process. I do think they should begin the process.
And of course, she thinks they should begin the process. And the only one speaking the truth in all of that was Al Green. You got this Alabama Democratic state representative, going after Donald Trump Jr., you know, using the R word, which I guess now you're not allowed to use it. And then saying he's the best defense for having an abortion. It doesn't get, but Al Green saying something that's true. Well, we better impeach him because otherwise he's going to get reelected. An acknowledgement that, yeah, he's going to get reelected. You know, but this is all part of the media madness in this country. I think, as I said yesterday, it's worse than it was on election night 2016 and the mass psychosis that then followed. And the hatred and the rage is, you know, they all thought Mueller, which is now officially dead. There's no more Mueller talk that is of any significance or meaning whatsoever. All it is now is noise. And Gerald Nadler trying to put on a show and moving towards some type of contempt effort against the attorney general because he wants to change a rule that's been established for 206 years. They're afraid to, I guess, interview Barr by themselves. They want their lawyers to do it. Well, that has not happened in the 206-year history of the House Judiciary Committee, of which he is now the chairman. Not once. So Barr is saying, well, I'm glad. Of course, Congress has the right to oversight, but oversight by the people that were elected that are accountable to their constituents, not strangers, because we're too weak to do the job. It doesn't work that way. You know, unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats, what, to cover for you? 800-941-SHAWN, toll-free telephone number. We're joined by Kayleigh McEnany, National Press Secretary for Trump 2020, and Jeff Lord. He has a new book coming out called The Swamp Wars, Donald Trump and the New American Populism and the Old versus the Old Order. Well, that's not, you know, I think a lot of the hatred of Trump, Jeff, and welcome back both of you, is it's all rooted in the fact that he's not them. He's never going to be them. If he cured cancer, gave every American $5 million, co-opted even the new Green Deal agenda, dropped another $150 billion on the tarmacs of the mullahs in Iran, they'd still hate him.
Yeah, they would, Sean. And, you know, I think one of the things that really drives this is that he could have been one of them had he chosen to be so. I mean, this is a guy who went to an Ivy League school there at the University of Pennsylvania, and he's made himself into a billionaire. How easy would it have been for Donald Trump to be one of them? he not only doesn't want to be one of them, I mean, he just rejects them out of hand, and they hate him for it. They just cannot abide him.
Well, I mean, you were one of the few of us that saw it coming. I'm beginning now to think, Kayleigh McEnany, that it was so bad post-2016. Remember, the exit polls showed that Donald Trump didn't win a state. And just like 2004, it showed John Kerry was going to be the next president. And I don't think this president in particular polls very well, just by virtue of the fact, I think a lot of people are like, you don't ask me your nosy questions who I'm voting for. It's none of your business. And frankly, if anyone asked me, I probably would have said Hillary. I never get asked. I've never been interviewed after I vote. But the point of it is their reaction from that day forward, once the night started to roll in and Donald Trump became clear he's the next president of the United States, there's this collective meltdown because nobody saw it coming, number one. And now the Mueller report, it seems that in spite of everything we have pointed out for the last 2 years, they weren't paying attention and they believed their own lies about Russia collusion. And now they can't handle the results of that investigation.
Exactly. And they can't handle the thought of the president winning re-election and them once again never seeing it coming. You know, you point out a key fact here. I talked to a pollster and they said, look, double digits. When I went out and polled the hidden Trump voter, tried to find that voter that told the pollster they were voting Clinton but really voted Trump, he found them to a double-digit tune. So that's why every exit poll was wrong. You know, Jeff and I were both on CNN set that night. I remember the Hillary folks rejoicing because all the exit polls showed Trump losing in virtually every state, like you noted. But how'd that work out for them? Jeff and I...
By the way, when did they stop going to you guys for commentary, and when did the depression begin to set in?
Yep, exactly.
No, it was on every single solitary network. I don't work election nights. I don't waste my time for the 5 seconds they'll put me on Fox. So I stay home and, you know, I'm looking up Cuyahoga County and Hamilton County and, you know, Southwest Florida, the Panhandle and Broward and Palm Beach counties to see if there's any cheating going on. And that's how I like to spend my election nights.
One of the stories I tell is that the Saturday before before Halloween in 2016, I put my then 97-year-old mom in the car to go out in the countryside and get pumpkins. And I noticed there were Trump signs everywhere, hundreds of them. I started counting. There was one Hillary sign. I get to CNN on the following Monday. I tell that story on the air, and they're all looking at me like I'm a loon. And they're saying, Jeff, the polling data. I mean, I tried to tell them there was something going on here. This is coming. It's, you know, I'm just not seeing it there for her in the middle of Pennsylvania. And they just, you know, wouldn't believe it.
Well, there was a funny thing because Joe Biden, I know he went to gave a union speech and he acknowledges that if he can't win Pennsylvania, he's not going to win. Here's the problem. The economy in Pennsylvania is so strong right now that they're actually going inside of prisons, asking the prisoners, when are you getting out? Because we want to hire you. That's a big problem. We now have 1.7 million more jobs available than we have people on unemployment. I mean,
when I drive around this area, all I see are, not all, but I certainly see more and more, plenty of now hiring signs. They're all over the place.
Sure, exactly. And I think that's the point. I think, you know, how do you win in that economy with that economy so strong, you know, that anybody that wants a job is working? That's why we have record low unemployment, a 50-year record low unemployment numbers in the country. Now, what they can't figure out is, well, it happened when Reagan was president. Now it's happening again when Trump is president. It's the same policies that they put in place, eliminating the bureaucracy, cutting back needless and burdensome regulation and lowering taxes and incentivizing investment. It's not that hard, Kayleigh.
That's exactly right. Free market policies work. We have the hottest economy on record, say maybe 1980, which was probably right there with us. So you're exactly right. In Pennsylvania, you point out lowest unemployment rate on record. And I can tell you this, the Democrats aren't going to win by going around and putting forth these policies like Joe Biden saying China's not a threat when meanwhile, you know, President Trump rightfully points out we lost 60,000 factories when China entered the WTO. It's an extraordinary number that even the Washington Post fact checkers, who we know are always off base, rated as true. So you're not going to win going around underestimating the threats we face from China against the hottest economy on record brought about by free market policies.
All right, as we continue with Jeff Lord and Kayleigh McEnany. So now we've got an issue that everybody pretty much in the media, there's a very small group of us that saw an entirely different set of facts emerging the last 2 years. And that is, oh, a rigged investigation into Hillary Clinton's email server, real obstruction of justice. Then we saw a dirty Russian dossier bought and paid for by Clinton with funneled money to Fusion GPS through a law firm, hiring a guy that we're going to break a big story tonight with our friend John Solomon about how everybody knew what Christopher Steele's agenda was, and they still used his dirty dossier, which the New York Times is even suggesting could be Russian disinformation from the get-go. How does Mueller justify not going into that issue? But that became then the basis of these four FISA warrant applications, the original in October of 2016 to spy on the Trump campaign. Now we've got Stefan Halper spying on the Trump campaign. And now we've got the added component of some, you know, a hot spy coming on to George Papadopoulos, flirting with him in an attempt. How many spies were there? How many attempts to spy on the Trump campaign were there? And who ordered it? And why wasn't any of that looked into by Mueller?
I mean, that's absolutely right. And, Sean, the thing that I think is so notable here is all these people that you have had on your show for the last 2 years have very patiently and relentlessly spent time unraveling the facts. Meanwhile, the mainstream media has gone out of its way to ignore the facts and bet the ranch on some collusion fantasy that just simply never happened. I mean, it is the most massive piece of journalism malpractice that I think we've ever seen in American history. That is a big story in and of itself right there.
Oh, I think it is, too. And it's, you know, do they care about the truth? No. Now, has anybody in the media apologized? No, they just doubled down on stupid. And I think if it was bad, their reaction to the 2016 election results, it's even worse to the Mueller report that they put so much faith, hope and trust in. Didn't come out the way they wanted, Kayleigh. And I just think at the end of the day, they're never going to change. There's never any hope for them. They are agenda driven at the highest level possible.
That's exactly right. And they commit journalistic malpractice regularly. Look, you know, you've reported on these huge scandals that have happened. This investigation started on a fraudulent document funded by Democrats. There's not been a single prosecution, by the way, but last week you have the New York Times finally confirming, hey, there were human sources on Papadopoulos, more than what we knew. How many networks picked up that coverage? How many newspapers ran with that coverage? None. Because they have an agenda, they're not going to change, and they're going to derelict their duty to report the facts and be journalists. They don't deserve that title that they hold.
You know, you just watch CNN fake news. You know, there's Wolfie Blitzer asking, will they throw the U.S. attorney in jail? You know, they're talking now such insanity that they'll send the sergeant of arms to capture the attorney general and bring him in handcuffs before Congress, as if that's going to happen. I mean, this is how insane. Then you've got NBC, this guy, what's his name? The guy before Rachel Maddow. Somebody Hayes. I don't know this guy's name.
Chris Hayes.
So he actually has a theory about a conspiracy where millions and millions of business owners were secretly plotting to damage Obama's economy. And then now they're secretly plotting together to benefit the Trump economy. And he's making these statements. I mean, How do you advance something that nuts?
Not for nothing do you call them conspiracy TV. I mean, it is just stunning to watch. I thought to myself, the real invisible headline here is Hannity was right, but we don't want to say it.
Yeah, no, listen. Yeah, I'm sure that the hell will freeze over first. Jeff Lord, thanks for being
That's
with us.
Right.
Kayleigh McEnany, thank you. When we come back, the president has granted clemency, a full pardon for former Army First Lieutenant Michael B. Hanna of Oklahoma. He'll join us in his first interview, and he had been sentenced to 25 years in prison for, quote, unpremeditated murder in a combat zone. President did a huge, did the right thing when you get to the details of this case.
Could we win a war with Iran?
Yes.
That didn't take you a second.
Two strikes, the first strike and the last strike.
What are the conditions or the circumstances that would justify going to war with Iran?
Well, if Iran struck out militarily against the United States or against our allies in the region, then I would certainly expect a devastating response against Iran.
As somebody who fought in two fronts in the Middle East, both in Iraq and in Afghanistan, do you think it would be a good idea to go to war with Iran?
No, I don't advocate military action against Iran. I'm simply delivering the message that if Iran were to attack the United States, it would be a grave miscalculation on their part, and there would be a furious response. Now, we don't want to govern Iran. We don't want to rule 80 million Iranians. We want 80 million Iranians to be able to govern themselves.
Where are you on regime change?
What I want is to have an outlaw regime change its behavior, to rejoin the civilized world and stop supporting terrorism and trying to overthrow the governments of so many of its neighbors. Ultimately, it's up to the Iranian people and their leaders to decide how they're going to govern their country. But with men like those in charge of Iran, I think we're going to see what we've seen for the last 40 years, which is a revolutionary theological movement that's hijacked the powers of a nation state.
I wonder if that means on any level to you that war is inevitable.
War is never inevitable. War is always the product of human choices.
All right, that was Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas. And in an interview, it took me by surprise. I'm going to get into this issue of the U.S. winning a war against Iran in two strikes. For those of you that don't know, Senator Cotton is a combat tour vet and served as a platoon leader for the Army's 3rd Infantry Regiment at Arlington. He actually has a new book out that pays homage to these soldiers who have gone before all of us and did what they did and served their country, many of them losing their lives in the course of that duty and honor in service for other people. And anyway, it's called A Soldier's Tour at Arlington National Cemetery. Pretty inspiring portrait of Arlington. If you haven't been there, you need to go. And Arlington Cemetery's old guard, but also chronicling his personal journey and time as a platoon leader in the unit. Senator, how are you? Welcome to the program.
Hey, Sean, it's great to be on the program, and thank you very much for your interest in sacred duty. You know, it's a great honor to be able to serve at the old guard in 2007 and 2008 between my overseas tours, and it was a great honor to spend the last year back at the cemetery with the soldiers of the old guard and to tell their story in sacred duty.
Well, this is important. An important part of your history is that for over 16 months in 07 and 08, you know, between combat tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, you served as the platoon leader of this old guard, the Army's 3rd Infantry Regiment at Arlington. These soldiers have been embodied, they embody the ideals of honor and sacrifice. So between that time, what did you actually do there?
Sean, I was a platoon leader with the old guard whose primary mission is military honor funerals in Arlington National Cemetery. We'd perform 20 to 30 funerals a day for veterans of World War II and Korea and Vietnam, and unfortunately active duty burials for those who had just been killed a few days earlier in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, we can do up to 100 funerals in a week. I probably did 400 to 500 funerals in my time at Arlington. But the distinguishing hallmark of the old guard is their pursuit of perfection in everything they do, their ethos of excellence, because even though we might have performed 20 to 30 funerals a day, we knew for that fallen hero and for that family at the gravesite, that was the only funeral they were ever going to see. That was a once-in-a-lifetime moment, and it was a lifetime in the making. And we owed it to our comrades in arms to pay tribute to them. We also knew that it helped create the next generation of guardians for this nation. Whenever young men and women see the way our nation honors our war fallen, know that they will be treated in the exact same way if, heaven forbid, they join the military when they grow up and they have to go downrange to fight and they lose their lives. I think it's a really important message that we send to the next generation of American that we started at the very beginning of this country back in the Revolutionary War and we carry forward to today, that there's no one we honor more than our warriors and especially those who have laid down their life in defense of our nation.
What is the reaction? Is it every time the same when taps are played or a 21-gun salute. I don't know if that's included in every funeral, but I know my father's buried in a military gravesite as well. He fought in World War II.
Taps is played at every military honor funerals. The big guns are fired at certain funerals for senior officers or for senior civilians inside the Department of Defense. But it's a mournful tune, and many families lose their composure. Obviously, the rawer and newer that the death was, the harder it is on the family. But, of course, that kind of thing sticks with you. It stays on your mind after the funeral. If you've seen a young widow receive the flag from you, sobbing at the loss of her husband and what it means to raise the two small children next to her without their dad for the rest of their lives.
Did you speak those words on behalf of a grateful nation? Did you do that?
We did. It's called condolences, Sean. And it's part of the test that all officers and NCOs have to undergo before they can be certified to perform a funeral in the cemetery. It's something that you don't forget when you bend down on a knee and you take that flag and you put it in.
Tell everybody the whole process, if you don't mind, walking through, because this is after they fold the flag that was draped over the casket, and it's folded with the honor that it deserves, and then take it from there.
Yeah. So once the family is next to the graveside, once everything is in position, I, as the officer in charge at the head of the grave, would step away. The chaplain would step in. The chaplain was the main link to the family. The chaplain would know about the soldier whom we were honoring, whether he had just passed away in Iraq and the conditions of his death downrange, or if he was a World War II veteran. The chaplain would perform a short service and then step out, at which point I would step back into the head of the casket. That was the cue for the casket team, which had been holding the flag taut, to begin to fold the flag. That is a precise maneuver. They have exactly 1 minute, 55 seconds to fold it into a crisp triangle and present it to me while the U.S. Army band plays usually either America the Beautiful or Army Blue. And then once it's presented to me, the casket team marches off, and I turn and walk to the next of kin. I take a knee, and I present the flag to the next of kin, and then I recite the condolences on behalf of the president and the Army and a grateful nation. And then I stand, and I salute, and then I return to the head of the casket while the funeral concludes.
Say the whole thing that you say to the family. So you take a knee, you present the flag, you have white gloves on. Yeah. I remember that part. And what are the exact words you say?
Yeah, so you go over, you do have your dress uniform on and the white gloves on. You take that knee and you present the flag, and then you recite the condolences. Now, the condolences have changed just a little bit since the time I was there. And that was done to harmonize them across all four services. And today, the condolences are on behalf of the President of the United States, the United States Army, and a grateful nation. Please accept this flag as a symbol of our appreciation for your loved one's honorable and faithful service. And when the next of kin takes the flag, you stand and you salute. One final salute to the flag that had adorned their loved one's remains.
Unbelievable. You know, we don't honor those brave men. We don't think. I mean, we don't wake up every morning and say, I'm so free, you know, and we take it for granted. I mean, like a lot of blessings in life. And then you think of all the people that have died in all the wars this country has had to endure. And America, as I often say, is the country. There's never been a country that has accumulated more power, abused it less. And we're not a perfect country, but also used it to advance the human condition more than the United States of America. It's just a fact. But let me ask you this question. Okay, go ahead.
No, I was going to say that's an absolute fact, Sean, and it's those young men and women, whether that they're at Arlington National Cemetery or with famed divisions like the 101st Airborne Division where I serve, that have done that good on behalf of our nation. And as you say, probably most of us in civilian life probably don't think enough each day about those Americans who laid down their life and the sacrifices their family made. But as I write in Sacred Duty, that's part of the reason why we have a unit like the Old Guard of Arlington. To every single day in the cemetery, whether it's at a military honor funeral or guarding the tomb of the unknown soldier for the 82nd consecutive year, to express our gratitude, our reverence, and even our love as a nation for those fallen heroes and their families.
We don't have the freedoms without these guys. We don't have this country without them. And again, you don't wake up every morning when you think of how profound it is. You know, no greater love have man for another than to lay down their life. And all these people have, it strikes you and you realize that the lives we enjoy are because of so many sacrificing. But let me ask you, while I have you on the phone, I want to, and by the way, it's a great book. It's coming out May 14th, Sacred Duty, A Soldier's Tour at Arlington National Cemetery. I have studied this Iranian situation a lot over the years. You know, I can remember when the Shah was removed and out of France comes the Ayatollah and the theocracy emerges. And I was very angry when Obama dropped $150 billion in cash and other currency on the tarmac in Iran for the mullahs that chant death to America and death to Israel, etc. They've been saber rattling the last week or so. You, in an interview, I believe it was on PBS, said that you believe the U.S. could win the war against Iran in two strikes. And I wanted to ask you about it because I think we're all pretty confident that they, as evil as they are, they have intelligently moved a lot of their nuclear sites all around the country, deeply embedded into the ground, and which would make taking those sites out alone a monumental military task.
Well, Sean, to be exact, what I said on PBS is that we would resolve the dispute in one strike. Because I said that if there were a military conflict with Iran, there would only be two strikes, the first strike and the last strike. What I mean by that is that we don't seek war with Iran. We're not taking military action just for the hell of it. But if Iran were to attack us, attack one of our ships in the Persian Gulf, attack our troops in Iraq, or attack the personnel, the thousands and thousands of citizens, in addition to diplomats and soldiers that we have living in the region, by taking the first strike against us, they would be guaranteeing that we take the last strike against them. They might start a battle. We would be the ones ending the battle, and we end it in a time and a manner of our choosing.
We lost 58,000 troops in Vietnam. I think grand total Iraq and Afghanistan, somewhere between 7,000 and 8,000, and so many more permanently injured, losing limbs, etc. And I've met many of the families, Gold Star families that have, you know, injuries that are forever life-changing. I don't like how we politicize war anymore. I don't like the idea that we don't fight them to win them. It seems we're all gung-ho when we start, then it gets seen through the prism of politics, and we're not winning it. And then it raises a question. When Harry Truman hit Hiroshima, Nagasaki, it was over. Did innocent people die? Yeah. We did not start that war either. My father served 4 years in the Pacific. Do we have to reconsider how war is fought and only get engaged? We can't have guys in Iraq going door to door anymore, and they don't even have up-armored Humvees, for crying out loud.
Yeah. So, Sean, it's not in our interest, nor should we desire to try to govern 80 million Iranians. I would much rather 80 million Iranians be able to govern themselves in basic stability and peace and not be a threat to the United States and a threat to the security of a vital region as well. That's why when I say that there would be two strikes, the first strike and the last strike, we would not precipitate, and we have not taken any actions to precipitate the increased tensions you see in the Persian Gulf region right now. The administration is responding prudently to very serious and credible threats against the United States, our personnel, and our interests in the region. I hope by virtue of the actions we've taken, deploying an additional carrier strike group and more bombers and Patriot missile systems, that we have sent the signal to Iran that they need to stand down from some of the threatening actions they're taking.
I just want the next generation of weaponry to be, I want our wars to be fought in Tampa. That's it. In other words, I want the next generation of weapons. We can't go door to door anymore. We can't do it. There's too many kids sacrificing. Then it gets politicized. Then you have to ask, well, why did we even begin it? And that infuriates me because it shows a lack of respect for what we're asking these kids to do. If you're going to fight a war, you better fight and you better win it, and you better win it fast. That's how we have to fight it.
I think what the Department of Defense is trying to do, what Chairman Joe Dunford is trying to do, is provide the options to the president should Iran strike the United States and our personnel or our interests.
I got to run though, Senator. I'm not trying to cut you off here, but we're just up on the clock. Listen, we really appreciate your time.
I got it.
Thanks for all you do. And the book is out May 14th. Sacred Duty, a Soldier's Tour at Arlington National Cemetery. There is a new book out that I've been reading and I am fascinated by. And very rarely do I say, wow, when you hear somebody that's got a little bit of intellectual honesty, probably doesn't agree with a lot of maybe my policies or where I stand, but see something that is so obvious to see, and they have a willingness to speak out. Now, there have been a few people, for example, with this deep state gate, the abuse of power, corruption, using the powerful tools of intelligence against the American people, rigging an investigation into one presidential candidate. And the evidence is overwhelming and incontrovertible that that candidate should have been put in jail. Then, of course, we're gonna get a FISA warrant application using a phony Russian dossier that the New York Times is now finally saying, oh, that was probably Russian disinformation. Great, because we had four FISA warrants that were used against the Trump campaign. One before the election to get a backdoor into all things candidate Trump, and then finally used to bludgeon the president, as we've now had, you know, for 2.5+ years, and it hasn't stopped. Just to give you a sense before we get to Brett Easton Ellis, who's with us, he's written a brand new book. It's called White. He's going to explain it in a second. He talks about those that just can't handle some simple, basic, fundamental truth. Listen.
So right now we have Hillary's about a 75% or 80% favorite. We have different versions of forecasts you can look at.
Poll has Hillary Clinton up by double digits nationally, 12 points, 50-38, a four-way race.
Clinton leading in Florida, Clinton leading in North Carolina, Clinton leading in Ohio, Clinton leading in Nevada. I could go on and on and on.
I continue to believe Mr. Trump will not be president.
It's been great. I love you. Come on, buddy.
We have a major projection right now. Donald Trump will take Ohio. And CNN projects Donald Trump will carry the state of Florida. Huge win for Donald Trump. Donald Trump, while we project, will win in Kentucky, in Indiana, with its 11 electoral votes. West Virginia, Florida, Tennessee, Mississippi, South Carolina, Alabama, North Dakota, with its 3 electoral votes, and South Dakota, Texas, Arkansas, Louisiana, the state of Montana, North Carolina, Georgia, Iowa, Utah, Wisconsin, Arizona, Kansas with its 6 electoral votes, Nebraska with its 5 electoral votes, and Wyoming with its 3 electoral votes.
Sorry to keep you waiting, complicated business.
A lot of people have laughed at me over the years. Now they're not laughing so much, I'll tell you.
No, they still can't face reality, which is the premise behind this brand new book. Now, it's written by Brett Easton Ellis. He's an author, screenwriter. It's called White, and he talks about the nanny state crying about the 2016 elections. You don't agree with much of my politics, I'm assuming, having read this book.
Well, I'm not partisan, you know. I'm in the middle of the aisle, and I always have been. And I didn't really pay attention to politics until this last election, where the mainstream news media that I trusted for all my life, whether it was the New York Times or CNN, I mean, I'm saying that now with a smile on my face, began to offer me this shifting reality that I didn't think was true about the campaign and about the election, and I started to pay closer attention to what was going on, and became seriously annoyed. Listening to that roundup that you just played is hilarious, but also deeply, deeply annoying, and I think the same thing can happen when you find those videos of election night on YouTube, much the same way that I think finding videos about people believing in the Mueller report for the last 2 years are also quite hilarious and are going to be played for generations to come on YouTube. You know, the media comes up with a narrative that they want to believe in, and I never really had seen that before. I hadn't seen the media actually play out like a fantasy that they had, and it was extremely disturbing to me.
You know what's scary, and you talk about it and you say it, actually you're very creative in your writing in terms of your writing style, which I like. You do have a great flair for writing, And you use a lot of expletives, which I always appreciate, having been from New York. But you're right. You know, the childlike disbelief that had manifested itself immediately after the election is embarrassing. And the post of what am I going to tell my daughter? And, you know, people that, and then on the other side, you would meet other people that would sit and quietly whisper to you, I'm voting for Trump, but don't tell anybody.
I describe this in the book. I live with a, my partner is far left, a socialist Democrat or, democratic socialist, whatever you want to call it. So I'm in their shoes. I get it. I hear it all the time. I don't agree with it necessarily at all, but I understand the other side to a degree. But I also did not understand this inability to get over the election. And it started to drive me crazy at a certain point. Okay, 2 months, 3 months, maybe 4 months. But when we hit the fifth month and my partner was talking about Russian conspiracy theories, and we're talking about in the spring of 2017, I started to lose it. And I started to say, come on, you've got to get out of this. You really don't believe that, you know, Russians helped win this election. And also that Russians had something to do with the Democrats losing 1,000 legislative seats whenever, you know, 2 years before, whatever. But he, you know, there was this belief that because Hillary lost the election, there had to be some kind of other reason that the country was just not, you know, ready for her or didn't want her. And so that inability, that childish inability to accept an election that was won legally and fairly began to become something ominous to me. And it played itself out through 2017, and then it started to play itself out through 2018. And the final chapter of my book is about the summer of 2018, where everything I felt imploded for the left. And how were they going to get themselves back together? And that really is what the book is about. It's about kind of my progression from being someone who, okay, well, you know, the people spoke. They wanted Donald Trump to be president. And yet there was this faction of a lot of people I knew who just couldn't accept it and started to create narratives and fantasies about why he won and were having meltdowns. I have seen Trump derangement syndrome in action constantly in L.A. and in California and among a lot of my friends. Not all of them. Okay, some of them accepted it, but it got to the point where I felt I had to write about it, and I began talking about it on my podcast, the Brett Easton Ellis podcast, on Patreon, and that's a lot, and that's where a lot of white comes from my podcast.
You know, I watched a lot of the anecdotes in the book are pretty amazing. Let me ask you, as you were watching this phony Russia-Trump, Trump-Russia conspiracy, it was like 99% of the media. And like usual, I go off in my own direction and I do my own thing. And fairly early on, I started developing sources that it was total BS. You even talked about an incident involving the P tape. I didn't know there was supposed to be 14-year-old Russian prostitutes till I read your book, but it didn't exist. And you talk about turning on to some of these, you know, networks, NBC, CNN. It was pretty much everybody. And everybody was looking at me like I had lost my mind. But I have a pretty good track record of being right, starting with Richard Jewell, Trayvon and Zimmerman, Ferguson, UVA, Duke Lacrosse, Baltimore, Maryland, vetting Obama, Trump can win, you know, that they don't have. And I just think that there, for example, it wasn't hard to tell that Obama was going to win just by looking at the crowd sizes.
Yes, exactly.
You know, I didn't go into a meltdown or a depression the moment this guy won that I thought wasn't capable of doing a good job.
Well, you know, the same thing happened with this Russian hoax that began forming itself immediately after the election that my partner grabbed onto because he couldn't believe Trump won. And so then I thought, okay, this is going to go away. This is going to go away in a while because was there really, really any proof? And as we moved through 2017, I remember talking to two journalists that I knew back from the day when I was living in New York, and they were now situated in Washington, D.C. And apropos of nothing, we just began talking on Facebook. And they both told me, apropos of neither one of them knowing each other, when I asked them, what's going on with this Russian conspiracy theory, both of them them, again, situated in D.C., told me it's utter BS. It's not true. Everyone knows it's not true, but they have nothing else. There's nothing else to go on. So you have this Russian conspiracy that sells papers, that gets clicks, and it's the only way that they can survive is to keep this Russian conspiracy thing going. And then I remember asking them, well, what's going to happen when it's found out to be not true? And they both said, there's going to be a dire reckoning. There's going to be a dire reckoning about people trusting the media who sold this for 2 years. And it's
Where is the reckoning? Because now all they're doing is pushing for Congress to do what Mueller didn't do. We've now had four separate collusions on Russia. We had the nine-month FBI investigation. Even Strzok and Page said, no, it didn't happen. They also said that the investigation into Hillary was rigged. It's clear she violated the law. And then we had, of course, the House Intel Committee, the bipartisan Senate Committee. Now the Mueller report can't be any more clear about Russia collusion, but they want another investigation. So they'll use a hyper-partisan Congress that believes in the Green New Deal that will eliminate oil, gas, the combustion engine, cows and planes, and everything is free. And that Congress will finally do the job that Mueller wouldn't do and the FBI wouldn't do and other people wouldn't do. They're still hoping.
I assumed that when the Mueller report finally came out and there was the Barr report and all that stuff, that people would finally just realize we've got to move on. We have to move on. Mueller was our God. We placed all of our faith in him in order to whatever he was going to do to Trump. And then ultimately what happened, there was kind of this depression for about a week, this kind of silence for a week, and then the people who wanted to believe in the Mueller report, like my partner, said, well, he's lying. It's not true. He's a stooge. The whole thing.
Well, wait till you tell him you're on the air with me. If he knows who I am, he's gonna go nuts.
Yeah, but he also knows that I believe in talking to everybody. Look, for this book, I've sat down with a profile for the New York Times, for the Washington Post. I also talked to Breitbart, and I'm talking to you. I mean, my partner's okay because Bernie Sanders was on Fox just about a week ago. And I think you just have to, you know, get rid of that and talk to both sides of the aisle. I hate this notion that people can only talk to
their
own. I agree
with you. I think it's stupid.
And it drives me crazy.
Stay right there.
So, yeah, maybe I don't agree with a lot of what you say or maybe what Fox represents, but I still believe that invite me on, I'm going to come on and talk.
Brett, I've been right the whole time. They were wrong the whole time. So I don't have much more to say, except the fact that you agree more politically with that side is what we're going to talk about on the other side of this break. Brett Easton Ellis, he wrote the book. It's called White, and it's going to be a bestseller. It's a very interesting read. I'm telling you, you can't put it down once you start. Talks about how the left has melted down in the country. And as we continue, Brett Easton Ellis is with us. He's an author, screenwriter. His brand new book is out, White, where he literally takes on the nanny state, everybody on the left, their complete meltdown over Donald Trump and his election and buying into these conspiracy theories. You talked about there's going to be a reckoning. I don't see the reckoning. Right. Well, I see.
No,
is they're just going
to. Right. And I think those reporters that I talked to in the summer of 2017 were thinking that was going to happen. But there's been no sanity about this. There's been no sanity about any of this. This has all been delusional. And, you know, and I think it's this delusion, this childlike delusion about the reality of things that has kind of upset me the most. I mean, I don't want to actually, believe that, you know, certain things are true or certain things are not. I mean, I like to think that there's a kind of logic to the world and also that you're an adult. You accept things. Okay, so it didn't work out your way. You move on. You find a candidate that can get Trump out of office in 2020, but you don't lose your collective mind. You don't have this meltdown. You don't act like children for 3 years, and you don't believe in fantasies. And in many ways, that's what propelled me to put White together. Again, as I said, Sean, I am, you know, I'm nonpartisan. I'm really not on either side of the aisle. But for some reason, the last 3 years of being around people who had actual Trump derangement syndrome and were completely believing in these narratives.
Well, let me just tell you one thing we may share.
Live in a real world.
I'm more critical of Republicans for being weak, visionless, spineless. They make promises, they don't keep them. The thing I love the most about Donald Trump is he's courageous. He keeps his word, his promises. He fights hard for everything he said he was going to do. How rare is that?
He's an individual. He's an individual.
He's a disruptor.
He's an individual and
iconoclast.
And I admire him for that.
Oh. All right. Well, listen.
Yeah, he's an individual.
I'd urge everybody. We're going to put it up on our website, Hannity.com. Brett Easton Ellis. It's called White, and it is a takedown of how the media and the left wing in this country have just lost their minds since the Trump election and these conspiracy theories that followed. Thank you. Good luck to you, Brett. And if you're in New York, let us know. We'll put you on TV.
Thanks, Sean.
Appreciate it.